people who are flying somewhere for, to get here as we speak, and others who had other conflicts. And since this is an unusual thing, having a seminar before the semester actually begins, does anyone know anyone else for sure who's coming? Those of you who... Okay, this isn't in the spirit of keeping tabs on who's, you know, on the list, who is or isn't here. But let me just go down just so I can see. So Thailand's not here. Tatiana's here.
Here.
Lindsay's here. Nina?
Yes.
You're Nina? Okay. Michael is here. David is here. Robert or Ian?
Ian.
Ian.
Yep.
Okay. And Nate is here. Matt Kearney. Nicole Kraus is not here. Nikki Kraus isn't here yet. I don't know if she. Lygia Luz Lopez. Okay. Johi Park. I know I got an email that Johi will be coming. I don't know. Joao is here. Emmanuel?
Yep.
Do you go by Emmanuel or?
Yep.
Trevor is not here, and I think he said he couldn't. And Aichev is here. Okay. I think we should, while we're waiting, we'll undoubtedly do this more than once during the semester, especially because a couple of people aren't here. Just briefly go around, introduce yourself, say just a little bit about your interest and how it intersects here, the seminar. We have a couple of people who aren't students in the department, in the university, who are part of the seminar. And my feeling is the ex officio people are full-fledged members of the seminar, so there's no differentiation in terms of their participation in any way, although they don't have to write term papers. But so why don't we all just introduce ourselves, and then I'll give some introductory comments.
Hi, everybody. I'm Lindsay. I am here because I am interested in looking at how different kinds of institutional arrangements produce different kinds of production processes and how that, in turn, affects those institutional arrangements.
Hi, my name is Emmanuel. I think, so my background is in economics, and my interest is generally also kind of in economic and social change. But I'm kind of skeptical about kind of endogenous social change. So I'm more interested in like how kind of environmental degradation, kind of energy crisis, kind of affect change in organization.
Yeah, my name is Nina. I'm from Denmark. I'm here as an exchange student for like one semester. So if you don't understand what I'm saying, just tell me. I'm here in Madison because you can't read this social economic at home, and I never ever had real courses in it, but of course you come around and during my bachelor and my master degree. So I'm just here to get to know the subject a little bit better. And
Ann Reynolds, and I'm one of the non-departmental people, obviously. I'm with the Center for Cooperatives here on campus, so my interest definitely is in the co-ops as a part of the social economy, but you know, I guess because I work a lot with just organizations, interested in a lot of issues around the organizational and certainly the social change piece of this.
I'm Tatiana, and I'm interested in generally in minority social movements and how they are able to overcome social and economic exclusion. And in this class in particular, to try to look at how some forms, some institutional or designs and some kind of arrangements in society are useful to overcome that social exclusion for those minority movements.
My name is Ian, and I'm a first year student in the Development Studies program.
And so I'm not a sociology student, although I'll be taking my social classes. But I've done previous work on microfinance in Mexico and have become interested in bigger capital flows and work sort of deals with the promise of industrialization. So I think this class should come in handy.
My name is Kathleen Doherty. I'm another unofficial. I am interested in the topic in particular based on some graduate work I did at Growing Power in urban agriculture, and in particular looking at food systems and different ways to organize food system delivery or food access. And when I started preparing for some classes that I teach, I encountered Eric's work and realized that that's a really good kind of a good theoretical basis for some of the stuff that I've studied at the Growing Power and looking at how it, as an organization, was able to kind of mediate between the institutional industrial food system and kind of the alternative food movements. And so I'm interested in looking at ways to, I guess, to mediate between those two systems and sit on the Willie Street Co-op board, so I have some background in cooperatives and food co-ops in particular.
And as I think, if you've looked carefully at the syllabus, you know, we're having a field trip on the 25th to...
Hi,
come on in. Hi. We're having a field trip to Milwaukee to visit Growing Power. And in the session, let's see if we can squeeze and make room for everybody at
just
one.
Going this
way. We're officially scheduled in a regular classroom. I always prefer people being huddled together in a more intensive, and the decorations of this room are conducive to alternative thinking. So, if additional people come, we might conceivably have to go to a bigger room. But so, in preparation for the Growing Power visit, we're going to read Kathleen's master's thesis that she wrote several years ago about Growing Power. And also some chapters from a person who's currently writing a dissertation on Growing Power from Columbia, who will come in for that session. And I, especially when we read Kathleen's, I think we'll have a double purpose for our discussion, the usual kind of discussion, just to figure out how we think about it. But I thought this could also be a nice collective brainstorming to see what iteration of that work would make a good publication. Which it certainly will. So it's just a question of us being a collective feedback source for that work. And Stephen.
So I'm Steve Vaselli. I'm just starting a two-year postdoc here to study the effects of the financial crisis on the trucking industry specifically. And relative to this class, I'm particularly interested in the potential for worker cooperatives in the transportation industry in general.
I'm David. My interests are economic sociology and political economy, and I think the material looks interesting.
I'm Michael. I'm interested in political economy and questions of, strategies of post-capitalist transition and how social movements, particularly labor movements, approach those questions.
Hi, my name is Joel, and I'm interested in alternatives to capitalism. And I think that class is particularly interesting, the way that you can think about how to organize for instance, production or circulation of services and goods in an alternative way. So that's my main focus for the class.
I'm Nate, and I'm especially interested in alternative ways of organizing agricultural economies and monetary systems.
I'm Matt, and I'm interested in alternative ways of organizing healthcare delivery and how that can intersect with building social power.
I'm Marcia. Up till now, I was doing quite a few things in urban sociology, and so I think increasingly I'm moving away from that. And I have a background in economics, so I do economic sociology, and along with the this side of the table, political economy.
I'm a PhD student in social work. My interests revolve around social welfare policies and income inequality.
Mm-hmm. I'm Juhi. I'm a PhD student in consumer science, and I'm interested in various kinds of consumer cooperatives and also ethical consumption and food practice.
Great. I'll give a little sort of pep talky kind of introductory thing. We have some practical matters to think through around details of schedule. And then I think we'll still have plenty of time for an open first round of discussion around some of the themes. So first, why I'm doing this seminar. Now, I said a little bit of this in the introductory material in the syllabus, but let me just say it again. Usually when I give seminars, it's on material that I feel fully in control of, and I have an idea of where I want the seminar to go and how to get there. I don't hide any of this. It's not like I'm secretively trying to manipulate people along some path, but I have a very clear sense of what the central punchlines of the work will be. That's really not the case here. I don't thoroughly know this literature, although I've begun to read quite a bit in it. I don't have what I would consider a stable conceptual handle on the social economy. My views on how best to locate this concept, to parse it, to give it precision, shift quite a bit in different contexts in which I work. So this is much more, in that sense, this will become much more, from my point of view, a collaborative seminar where we will jointly be exploring this material. Some of the things we'll be reading I haven't read yet, which is normally something I really never do in a seminar. I mean, when I began as a professor many years ago, I did such things, and so often it turned out to be really a dumb move. That is, I would assign impenetrable work that I couldn't figure out once the seminar read it. So I do have as a general policy that I don't assign things to students unless I've thoroughly read it, and I can vouch, yes, this is worth the trouble. Well, I've at least skimmed through everything. I didn't just pick stuff randomly off of the shelf, but I have not carefully read everything that's assigned. One of the things that means is if you start reading something and you really think it's boring and tedious and you're not going to learn anything from it, you might be right. I can't give you a guarantee of my seal of approval. Now, most of the things that I've assigned, I have read, so it's not like I've just done this for the entire semester. But it does mean, I think, the spirit of the seminar is, from my point of view, one in which I'm hoping to advance my own understanding a lot in the course of our discussions. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to do this seminar. In terms of my work, This broad topic area falls squarely within the agenda of what I called envisioning real utopias. Thinking through the problems of alternatives to existing institutions of power and inequality, where you simultaneously worry about the sort of deep normative foundations for alternatives and about the real constraints of institutional design. I tend to, in these discussions, bracket, in the first instance, the problem of whether an alternative is achievable. Not that I don't think achievability is important, but I think it's a mistake to put the question of what we can achieve before we understand what we want to achieve. That is, if we limit our discussion of alternatives to those things which we have good reason to believe we could accomplish, we'll tend to short-circuit the discussion about what would be the optimal designs. And then it also, I think, is the case that to the extent we can clarify viable alternatives, alternatives which would work if we could get there, that also tends to open up at least the ideological space for new possibilities of what we can achieve. So my own personal focus is on the viability of alternatives more than the achievability, although of course the two come into play. People who are deeply embedded in social movements as activists more often are preoccupied with the achievability question. You know, they're engaged in a struggle. They want to know, what can we accomplish in the kind of time horizons in which you can feasibly organize collective action and community groups, which is not decades into the future. It's how do you deal with the pressing problems that you're confronting and what can we do? So this is a delicate and interesting question, and I think the social economy will provide us with a lot of occasions to play off against each other, these two issues. What can you do now? What is to be done? And what do we ultimately want to achieve? And how do we think about achievability in connection with all of that? So that will certainly be a recurring theme. I do not want to impose as a kind of discipline on the seminar a kind of a ban on the discussion of practical, achievable objectives in the here and now. You know, I'm just telling you where my own preoccupations come from. I think it's fine for us to be continually moving back and forth between the immediate struggles that occur in particular communities of garbage pickers and recyclers in Bogota, to pick a random example. You know, and how they have formed a stable alternative circuit of processing of waste that achieved certain real measures of improvement in the lives of people, even if it's not a design for some system level alternative. Okay, so we'll be playing back and forth. So why then the social economy? As I'm going to use the term for the seminar's purpose, I'm using it as the big umbrella term, right? Not in the narrower sense that in the Envisioning Real Utopias book, I use it in a more restricted sense, trying to identify the term social economy with a very specific way of pathway beyond capitalism. Here, I think for the seminar's purpose, it should be thought of as an encompassing umbrella term. And its meaning comes from the, as sometimes people say in discussions of concepts, from a contrast space, where the social economy is contrasted to other things. So you can't define it except in its contrastive way, in a contrastive way. And the standard list that I use for this purpose is the social economy, the capitalist economy, the state economy, and the family economy. So if you just think of the four basic broad ways that economic activity is organized. It can be organized by capitalist firms, it can be organized by states, it can be organized by families for their internal economic activities, and it can be organized by, quote, the social economy. That's defining it as a residual category in a way. As we have a clearer positive definition of the other three, and everything else that has some sense or other is embedded in communities, in social networks, in civil society, all of those other things I'm putting in the calling the social economy. What we'll find, of course, very quickly is that while that may motivate the big umbrella concept, it doesn't give us sufficient theoretical precision to really understand this category. And that's a lot of what we'll be talking about as the semester goes on. We're going to be figuring out, for example, how do worker-owned firms, worker cooperatives, fit into that typology. So in some ways, worker-owned firms are kind of capitalistic. They produce for a market, they make profits, they compete. But in other ways, they're embedded in social relations of community, of reciprocity, which defines the cooperative aspect of co-ops. And different kinds of co-ops in different times and places may be more or less capitalistic or more or less embedded in this more purely social economy kind of concept. And this, of course, brings us to what will be another one of our big themes throughout the semester, the notion of hybrids, that actual empirical instances often combine many different elements. Many things in the context of social economy that I've done the most research, Quebec, many of the organizations and enterprises in the Quebec social economy also have a significant state component. Even though they're not run by the state, they're still not completely autonomous from the state. So just to finish this initial pep talky part, I care about the social economy because it seems to me one of the things we need to sort out in the project of envisioning alternatives to capitalism, that alternatives to capitalism need to be thought of not merely as system-wide mode of production alternatives in the kind of classical way that Marxists have thought about historical transformations, but rather we need to think about alternatives to capitalism in ways that also help us understand how alternatives are being produced inside of capitalism itself. And the social economy is one of the domains where people, in practice, on the ground, make alternatives. They make those alternatives real. We need to theorize them and then think through the problem of how to unbottle, how to open up the spaces so that these alternatives can become a bigger and more pervasive reality. The question which I can't answer, and yet, probably never, is my guess, and I don't think it's a fail, I mean, my current view is, this is not because of a failure of imagination, it's because of an opacity of the problem. I don't think it's possible to answer definitively the following question. Are these alternatives, which get generated and produced inside of the existing structures, are these merely niches that fill spaces that are possible and are ultimately constrained by their conditions of compatibility with capitalism? Or do they constitute the basis of a corrosive element, which, because it contradicts the logic of capitalism, can provide one of the bases for moving beyond capitalism? Is there a kind of equilibrium in which all of these alternatives, however much we like them because of the values they embody, nevertheless will always and forever be constrained to be contained within the overall framework of a capitalist economy, and therefore can't really pose a challenge? That's the kind of most sour pussy negative view. Or is it really the case that slowly over a very long period of time in enough new ways, in combination with the other contradictions of capitalism, which make it less stable, these alternatives can become the kind of core of an alternative system, which emerges in the interstices of capitalism, and then under unspecified contingent historical conditions can become a dominant alternative? Well, I know I'm prone to wishful thinking. I think left intellectuals who are serious are always prone, and should be. I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing to be prone to wishful thinking, because if you weren't prone to wishful thinking, the reasons for pessimism are so enormous that without a little dose of wishful thinking, it would be very hard to maintain such visions of transformation. So I know that's operative. It's what makes certain kinds of optimism possible. But I think still we want to can try to nail down that issue as much as we can. I don't have an answer to that question, though. I also think anyone who thinks they do have an answer, you know, I'm in many discussions with people who are deeply engaged in these questions in more or less Marxian ways, and frequently people think that they really do know for sure the answer to that question one way or the other. I just think we don't have a grounding for that. All right, that's my personal pep talk as to why I think this stuff is important. I mean, if anybody wants to react to any of this, we have enough time this afternoon not to feel we have to be too disciplined in terms of getting through the organizational agenda and stuff right away. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask what people generally say, what evidence people offer on either sides when they take a position.
So The anti-corrosion thesis, you know, that basically there's no possibility of transforming capitalism except through a ruptural confrontation, And if that's not possible, then nothing's possible. I mean, the argument there is that it's basically an argument about the coherence of power, that capitalist power is sufficiently too strong, and their capacity, because of their control over surplus, is so great to buy off any challenges that there's no way to confront it. And that these strategies, the strategies that are interstitial, that build co-ops, that create alternative circuits, all of these things, none of them challenge the basic capacity to appropriate surplus, and therefore the basic power of capital. So unless there's something else which destroys that power, something exogenous to the social economy strategies, like global crisis that completely destroys capitalism, you know, something like that, this will always remain on the fringes. So that's the argument against it. The argument opposed to that is that that's an overstatement of the power of capital, that the nature of social systems are not integrated totalities, that kind of organic totality view of the way an economy works and a social system works is simply not an adequate way of understanding systems. Systems are contradictory, not simply in the kind of crisis-generating sense that Marxists thought, but that they're loosely coupled, and contradictory forms can develop and be reproduced within them, and that it isn't so easy for capital to simply move against those forms, depending upon the circumstances. And therefore we just don't know, you know, the kind of responses. We don't know if it's the case that these alternative forms can develop sufficient conditions for their own reproduction, that they can become stable alternatives which people can choose. So this is the kind of Proudhon, for those of you who know something of the history of 19th century debates on these things, one interpretation of Proudhon's view about worker co-ops. And the early, well, not just early, but the kind of anarchists' view about these things, is that they would provide such a better quality of life for people that people would opt for them. You know, workers can choose. Should I work in a capitalist firm? Should I form a co-op? And if you get a sufficient density of co-ops, the co-ops can help support the formation of new co-ops. There are places in the world where that's happened, where co-ops breed co-ops, and that this provides genuine possibilities of choice. Now, it's not the case that workers can necessarily decide to opt to form new co-ops or to join co-ops without facing any trade-offs, but that alternative kind of economy can be created, and that it isn't so easy for capital to just come in and smash it, because the capacity to resist that can be very organic within communities as well. That's the kind of argument that would be made on the other side. Yeah, Joao.
I think it might be true that it's intellectually hard to answer that question, but when you get to the activist level, people in general, they have an answer. Otherwise, because the interstitial transformation or ruptural transformation, they entail very different understanding of why of how you're gonna move against capitalism. So if you're gonna have to organize for a systemic transformation, you choose a different organizational path than if you go for interstitial transformation. So you take a stand, and in general, people
do answer, they do, of course, they formulate answers. It doesn't mean the answers are well grounded. And the problem is that if you believe that you can't transform a system without rupture, and therefore you don't engage in significant interstitial change, that may, of course, make rupture even more difficult. But if you believe that if you put your energy in interstitial change, but believe that it's all kind of pointless because it's not going to accomplish anything, then, you know, you can't accomplish interstitial change as well. Yeah.
And isn't, I mean, the historical evidence for the last 200 years quite clear that a kind of evolutionary approach to interstitial kind of change hasn't really worked, because capitalism has been expanding. Like the kind of the trend hasn't gone the other way around.
Well, the question is, what's the time horizon within which one can have a reasonable grounds for saying something works or doesn't work? If you use the model of the transformation of feudalism into capitalism, capitalism developed as an interstitial transformation of feudalism, did not develop as a confrontation against feudalism, developed slowly over, you know, more than decades, over centuries, of expanding the space for social interactions, forms of economic innovation that were not under the rules of feudalism, but still complemented and fit into feudalism, but ended up being corrosive. Now, of course, I don't mean to mechanically say, well, just because that's the way capitalism developed in feudalism, that's the way an alternative to capitalism will develop within it. No, there's no law of there's no dialectical law which says that every transformation has to have the same kind of logic. But I think the time horizon for interstitial transformations should be thought of as very long rather than short, and therefore in some ways not open to full strategic action. It's too long. The time horizon is too long for full strategic action. That is where a group says, yes, we're going to engage in interstitial transformation, and if we haven't transformed the system within 15 years, we know we failed. That's not the character of this project, process of change. We'll return to a lot of this, I'm sure, many. Well, let's deal with these practical, logistical questions about exactly what the scheduling should be, the timing, and so on. There's a number of considerations, just so everybody knows. There's a couple of people who are TAs. Are they here, the TAs in Pam's class? Okay, so there are two people who have TA assignments, which means starting at 2, you'd miss 15 or 20 minutes each time?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So one solution to that problem is that on days when they're... Oh, just so everybody knows, the reason for the particular timing constraint is that the Haven Center has periodic lectures. This semester there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there are 6 of them, mostly in the second half of the semester. But one next week, but mostly in the second half. And those lectures start at 4, and I know many people in the class will want to attend most of those. Some have to attend all of them because they work there on the Haven Center. Two people have to, they're on the Haven Center staff. So, but those are also an important part of the life in the department for those of you who are new to the department, the Haven Center series. And so we, on days when there's a Haven Center lecture, we have to stop at 4. On days when there's not a Haven Center visitor, there's no reason at all. So one element of a solution to that problem is on non-Haven Center days, the seminar goes from 2:30 to 5:30. When I block out a 3-hour period, I don't mean that necessarily every week we actually stay for 3 hours. I think that just depends on the material and how it goes. So sometimes it'll be 2.5 rather than 3. But so on non-Haven Center weeks, the seminar could go 2:30 to 5:30. And that solves the TA problem. Right? There's one person, is the person who wants to take Tom DePreet's seminar here?
That's Trevor.
So that's only one person. So there was a seminar that was scheduled originally for Wednesday morning, which has moved to Wednesday afternoon. So to accommodate that problem would mean a complete change in the schedule rather than just this tweaking in the weeks when there's a Haven Center person. And the only options there would be Wednesday morning, but I assume that's going to interfere. I imagine there's other people that have conflicts Wednesday morning. the other option then is Wednesday night, just to make it an evening seminar.
I have class on Wednesday night. So.
What's your class on Wednesday night?
It's formal modeling.
Oh, our game theorist. If ever in the course of the semester we confront a theoretical problem that has some really deep game theory component.
I'll draw a model.
We'll ask Joao to draw a model. Okay, well, I think that, I think conflicts are almost always inevitable. So let's not, if we meet 2:30 to 5:30 on non-Haven Center days, the question then is what do we do on Haven Center days? Because 2:30 to 4 makes a pretty short seminar.
Can I make an observation? Of the classes that have assigned reading to them, there's only one that's a Haven Center day, and it's next week.
There's some slight changes. Well, there's October 20th is a possibility. Well, there's a guy named Matt Hancock who's a specialist on cooperatives in Middle Italy, in this sort of band of this part of Italy that has a very dense network of cooperatives. He knows a huge amount about that. Ann Reynolds suggested that I get in touch with him, and he's very eager to come and come up from Chicago, where he's based, and have us do a seminar on this region of co-ops, which I would really like to do. And the 20th was one of the possible dates for that. So that means that there will be a couple of times during the regular part of the semester where an evening class might be a good thing to do because of the 4:30 till the 4 o'clock constraint on the Haven Center. The 20th would be an example. Now, your class on Wednesday nights is when exactly?
It's from 5:30 to 7:30.
So, I mean, we could do it, have it start at 7:30.
But then in general, on the Haven Center's week, we have the dinner with the professor on the Wednesday.
We're going to make the reception on Tuesday just to avoid any conflict with this. And the, some of these Haven Center visitors could come to the session as well. One thought
I... The reception is on Tuesday.
What?
The reception is on Tuesday.
Yeah, that's what we were...
At what time?
Well,
7:30 or 7, something like that. Mm. At my house for the Haven Center people.
Because isn't there also a 7 o'clock movie for
your
class
125? Yeah, but I mean, the undergraduates in my class can watch the movie without.
Okay.
We'll have to work on the logistics of somebody has to be at those movies, right? But that doesn't affect this class. So here, let me pass this around. This was a proposal. I hadn't realized that there was an evening constraint. So this would have to be tweaked. One of the conflicts with Haven Center was Yochi Bankler. Yochi Bankler wrote this book, The Wealth of Networks. This is a whole different aspect of the social economy problem, that is intellectual property rights and the role of the internet and information technologies in creating a whole new kind of economic space. He's coming as a Haven Center visitor. It occurred to me, we haven't scheduled in the existing syllabus, this discussion was scheduled for the 13th of October, I believe. Yeah, it occurred to me it would make more sense for us to schedule our discussion the week he's here and have him come to our seminar.
Sure.
So that means that, and that's what I'm proposing on the bottom of this, is that on the 13th that we have the Matt Hancock visit, on the 20th, which is a Haven Center visit, we not have a regular seminar discussion, that that be the beginning of the second phase of the seminar where we're going to be discussing the ongoing research projects. And then we have the Bankler visit. We have an evening seminar, which could start at 7:30, you know, following his talk, so that he would give his lecture on Wednesday. We would have read the book, and then we would have our own seminar with him Wednesday evening. So if we schedule that at 7:30, I mean, I know it's a pretty intense day for you. But
it's going to be tense for him as well. He's going to talk on Tuesday, twice on Wednesday, and then on Thursday.
No, he's coming on Wednesday, then on Tuesday.
So he's
coming on Wednesday.
And then he's giving a Wednesday talk, a Thursday,
and Thursday, a Friday.
And a Friday. Yeah, so this is still definitely intense, but I...
We're paying.
I don't know. That's the oh, you know what? I didn't push. Oh, some you did push this. Okay, yeah, for Thailand. It got pushed. It got pushed.
I have it.
does that? I mean, I think what it would mean if we start at 7:30. It's hard to go much. I mean, 9:30 is. Some of I know you young whippersnappers. Stay up to all hours of the night. It gets a little tough for some of us to have a seminar going until 10 or 10:30. How does 7:30 to 9:30 for those weeks sound to people? Does that work? Are there... So this would be on the proposal here. We change to 7:30 to 9:30 rather than 7. On the 20th, that will not be a reading and discussion section. I'm calling it an open session here. We can wait a little bit to see exactly what we want to do for that session, but it will be not a. There won't be readings for that week, and then the last session. I'll check with Matt Hancock. He said he could come on the 20th. I'll propose that he come on the 13th and discuss that with him. Okay, so that means Trevor unfortunately has to make a choice between the two. Seminars, because I think DePreet's stratification seminar is exactly the same time as this Wednesday afternoon. All right. Okay. Other organizational details. by the way, is that? It's. I assume it's okay with everyone to be adding this session on cooperatives in Italy that Matt's doing. Okay. Now, as I explained in the... Does anybody need a copy of the syllabus? I assume since I sent it, people would have... But I do have... Pass this down. Anybody? Anybody else? Okay. As I explain in the proposal, I'm hopeful that by only having the reading and discussion format for the first half of the semester, which was also the reason for having a session of the seminar before the semester actually begins, to sneak in an extra week, in effect, that it will be possible for everyone to actually finish a paper for the semester, during the semester, so we can avoid the usual practice of nearly everyone in seminars I teach handing in late papers, not out of lack of diligence, but simply a lack of time. I've eroded that a little bit by adding the cooperatives discussion, but I still think this gives... 6 weeks basically without any additional work aside from working on papers. I also really was hoping that we could form research teams, people whose interests are sufficiently overlapped that they could do a joint project. Now, joint projects can be broken down into quite distinct pieces. I'm not trying to coerce everybody into writing a kind of completely unified paper, but my experience in seminars where I have really encouraged joint projects is that people have found it incredibly useful and productive. It doesn't actually mean it's less work in terms of working on a project together. I've noticed several people are interested in food and agricultural issues, for example. There may be a number interested in health-related issues. Several people talked about co-ops as something that they're interested in. So it'd be nice if we could create kind of circles within the seminar around whatever themes people feel they're interested in, and then tweak that as we need to. It also, you know, it was the reason why I didn't put any constraint on the numbers in the seminar. If we're in the vicinity of 18 people or so, and 18 papers are getting written for a seminar, that it's not just that it makes the work for me more. It means that our weekend retreat at the end also becomes a different kind of thing. It becomes a kind of exhausting marathon of paper presentations rather than this intensely manageable weekend conference. So I'm hoping that everybody can pair up. The ideal group is 3 or 4. 2 is possible, but I think 3 or 4 people are better. There's more synergies that get formed, more real learning process that can go on within it. Now, I think we should wait a couple of weeks, kind of let the dust settle, see who's actually here. Of course, you can be thinking about what you want to do. As you get into the material and read more and begin to think more about exactly what you're interested in, you might write a memo, which will circulate, of the range of things that you're interested in. And then in a couple of weeks, I think I specified somewhere in the syllabus when I want to have that discussion. Let's see. On the 15th, so that would be 2 weeks from today, on the 15th, I think we'll have an initial discussion, some brief discussion of just where people are at around their themes, and 2 weeks later, in week 5, we'll actually form research groups. So think of September as the month in which you'll figure out and formulate exactly how you want to proceed on this. Once we're done with the reading and discussion format for the semester, my thought is that we still meet every week, but it could be short. You know, I think it'll be flexible exactly how we meet. But my thought is to actually meet, and each week for each group to give some kind of report. Some weeks then, a particular group will say, we're stuck, we really need help on something, and then we'll have a brainstorm discussion. On any given week, if a group wants other members of the seminar to read something, if you want to prepare a memo, I would say anything that is given to me by the Monday of the week in question will have a critical mass at the seminar that will have had a chance to read it by Wednesday. If I'm expecting that these won't be 50-page single-spaced memos. They'll be, you know, a few pages around some issue that you'd like to discuss. So my thought is that, nevertheless, that every week each group gives some kind of report just to see how things are going. But those would still be seminar meetings. Of course, in addition, outside of the seminar, I'm happy to do individual consultations with anyone in the class with respect to their research. Then this all culminates in a weekend retreat, which some of you have been to one, or nobody's been to more than one of these that I've done, right? So my general strategy in seminars is to, at the end of the semester, have a weekend workshop mini-conference where students present their papers as more or less as they would in a formal professional academic conference. So the idea is to both get practice with that task, which is you've been working intensively, you've got, you know, a fantastic 40-page paper that your group has put together. You got to figure out how to present it in 20 minutes, which is the standard slot on an academic panel. So if we have 7 or 8 of these projects, somewhere between 6 and 8 projects, depending upon how it all sorts out, that's a nice number because we can then really have good discussions of them at this weekend retreat, which we hold at a University of Wisconsin facility north of Madison on the Wisconsin River. The this center, I hold these things either in December or in May, depending upon the semester of the seminar. The advantage in December is, if we're lucky, there'll be a lot of snow. And as we discovered last year, some of you did, and in any case, they have a toboggan run at this conference center. So we spent a couple of hours tobogganing down this. A proper toboggan run is on rails. You know, it's a sled on rails that goes down a steep hill and then ends in a snowbank. So if we're lucky, we'll have a toboggan run afternoon at the conference. There'll be another event at the same site in the spring because the Haven Center is running a year-long series, which a number of people here have been heavily involved in organizing, called Socialism for the 21st Century and How to Get There. So we've got 8 Haven Center visitors in the course of the year on that topic. And then in May, we're going to have a weekend conference on the themes of that whole year's seminar with people coming from other campuses. And that'll also be held at Upham Woods. In the spring, there's canoeing around, canoeing on the Wisconsin River, so other attractions. So the one thing I just want to check on, is everybody able? You know, sometimes people have family constraints and others that make it impossible to do a weekend retreat. Is this something that everybody can do? And it's possible, by the way, what I've done in the past on these, people are encouraged, not just it's okay to bring friends and spouses and partners, and we even had children come and then work out some arrangement. There's lots of things that kids can do at this facility too, so there'll be plenty of time to plan all that, but you're welcome. You're also welcome to invite someone, anyone you'd like, to come to the Milwaukee field trip that we'll do on the 25th. When we get closer to that, we'll work out the logistics of carpooling to get there. And one possibility is the other person whose work we'll be reading, Emmanuel Pratt, at least when I talked to him last, he said he was interested both in coming to the seminar that week, September 22nd here, but also after we do the tour of Growing Power to hold a seminar there to discuss it after we've actually seen the operation and had a chance to engage it. Okay, those are my all of my logistical themes. Any reactions, thoughts?
Yeah. I have a question. The syllabus didn't say anything about due date for the final paper or about page length. Do you know what those things are, or do you want to leave that to later?
Well, there's no, I never put page restrictions on papers other than to remind people that bigger is not better. You know, so there is a, the requirement is that it be concise and to the point rather than a lot of beating around the bush to get to what you're talking about. But I don't put any page restrictions on it. That short papers can also be fantastically good if they're really honed, so I'm not worried about the length issues. These are meant to be serious research papers. drafts of something, the ideal paper is a draft of something you'll eventually publish. This is another little pep talky thing, which some of you who have taken seminars from me know. This is my view. Once you're a graduate student, you never should do homework. Your days of homework, that's what you do when you're an undergraduate. There are occasional graduate courses which have a homework-y quality to them, you know. I suppose it's hard to treat a problem set in a statistics class as something other than homework. certainly when you're doing a graduate seminar like this is not homework. We're reading together, we're going to be writing these memos, you're going to be doing papers because it's what you want to do with your life. You know, this is what you're doing. You want to be an academic, you want to write things because it's important to you to write things. And you should be writing because you want to be part of a conversation in the world about what you're writing. So seminars are a kind of contained space within which you can work on developing those skills, but the product should be a real product that you want to share with the world. That's partially why I have a workshop conference at the end of the semester, because that symbolically affirms that point. But in fact, I think a successful seminar is one in which if there are 10 papers in the seminar, 5 eventually get published in some form. And that can be many iterations later and embedded in other work. I'm not saying that these are actual drafts of a submission to a journal, but that's the way to think about it. You know, from now on, whenever you write something, it's because you want to share it with other people, rather than just with the professor to get a grade on your transcript. That's the stance towards it. It also implies that, to the extent possible, I like to treat my interactions with you as colleagues. You know, I'm older, I've been around the block more times, but so I can do some mentoring in my collegial relations, but I do that with junior faculty as well. And I think graduate students are just junior faculty. You know, it's one step before that official role, as opposed to you being students in the kind of subordinate role kind of way. That's my perspective on it, and I hope that you all kind of embrace that attitude. So you should really be thinking of something you want to write and eventually publish in some form or other. So there's no page length. The due date, I'm really hopeful that by the workshop, you know, at that event, people can hand in their papers. Rather than they're working from notes on the weekend of the 12th, and then 6 weeks later I get the paper. That's the weekend before the end of the semester. We won't have, my current feeling is that the week before that we won't have any class. You know, there's no need for the kind of brainstorming, problem-solving discussion 2 days before the weekend retreat. That's a little late for that. So on December 8th, there'll be no class at all. And I'd like to have the papers handed in at that weekend retreat. I don't impose sanctions for late papers. I think the punishment has to fit the crime, as it were. So the main punishment is that I'm annoyed. And it's not that I'm fierce, but, you know, you make me suffer by making me annoyed. I don't dock people grades for late papers. I don't, in a seminar like this, I won't refuse to write comments if you hand in a late paper. There are no sanctions at all. Because if I'm dealing with colleagues, I don't punish my colleagues when they don't hand in a paper that they promised me when they do. So that's of course that's not an invitation for you to take advantage. It's not to your advantage to take advantage of it. It's your advantage to treat the extra time that's given by having the seminar not be intense all the way up. You know, some seminars have masses of reading up to the very last day of the seminar, and then you're expected to hand in a paper 2 weeks later. It's ridiculous, I think. So we have a lot of reading until the middle of October. During that time, you formulate your projects, you get your research team together, you begin your initial thinking, but then you've got the rest of the semester open and free to really do a project. Okay? And for Kathleen to revise hers
or an actual publication. I also think as a general practice we should take a break in a seminar rather than slog through for 3 hours. This would be a little earlier. Normally you sort of go halfway, but I think this would probably be the best time to take a break, because then we can come back and then begin, have a discussion around my framework for analyzing these things. Normally, one other practical matter. My standard format for seminars, which some of you know, is, and it's also described in the syllabus, is that each week, each participant writes an interrogation of the reading, gets that to me, I forget what I've said this time, I probably said by midnight on Sunday or something, or Monday, by midnight Monday. Let's see. I say midnight on Monday. So by midnight I mean when I wake up on Tuesday, it's there, right? So it's not that I'm going to be lurking at my computer at midnight to see. So if you had, and there are remarkable night owls who at 3 in the morning, according to the date stamp, that's when the interrogation arrives. That's fine. I just mean so that when I get to it on Tuesday. So you send me your interrogations. I get them. I assemble them into a packet, which I then will either send around to everybody or put in a Learn at UW Dropbox, you know, online. Do people have a preference for that? I mean, last seminar I did it in the Dropbox format, but that won't be accessible to.
Right. No, unless,
you guys won't have. You could probably get access to it.
I don't know if I'm not involved in the class.
Maybe not. Initially, I'll send them around to you. I'll find out if I can add guests.
Yes, right.
I might be able to add guests to the Dropbox system. The Dropbox system has some conveniences, obviously, but otherwise, I'll send them around to everybody. What I do is I distill an agenda for our discussion from those interrogations. So the interrogations are really quite important, because what we end up talking about, how we focus in on the work, is generated by the agendas that you bring to bear on the reading. Occasionally, I will add some agenda items that are not covered, but I, knowing enough of the cast of characters here, I'm pretty sure that there aren't any issues that I would think should be on the agenda that somebody isn't going to raise. Now, what that means is that you really have to treat the interrogations in the following way. The purpose of the interrogation is to set up a discussion. It's not to show me that you've done the readings. Right? This is not a surveillance device on my part to see if you've actually done your homework. Right? No. You are saying, this is what I want to talk about. Now, it's not so easy to write a few hundred words explaining why you want to talk about something in a way that actually sets up a discussion. You'll find that that's hard. And then, since everybody's going to read everybody's interrogations, you'll pretty quickly realize some of these don't actually set up a discussion, and some do. So this is another kind of skill to hone. Just keep in mind, you read something, what do I really want to talk about? What are the things that I don't understand? Your interrogations don't have to be some grand, earth-shattering, foundational question, you know, raising deep, meta-theoretical, epistemological, and ontological questions about the objects of our inquiry. No. They can be things that you're just puzzled about, you're confused about, you don't understand something in the reading, you don't understand some distinctions. It's fine for the interrogations to just be interrogations of the reading, because you don't see what the point is. And you want your fellow students, participants in the seminar, to help you figure it out. It's also fine, of course, to raise foundational issues around some question. I then read these through. Depending upon my constraints, from other things that and deadlines I have. I do try to write comments on all the interrogations, so when I send them around, you get my comments on the interrogations plus the interrogations. Sometimes I just don't have time to do that. But I'll then distill an agenda, and I'll order it in whatever way I think will make the best sequence. When we come to class, then everybody will have read the interrogations, because I'll get those to you by Tuesday night, so you'll have Wednesday morning. And I know sometimes it's not possible to carefully read them through, but try your best. I will then distill an agenda. I will attach names of people from whose memos I derive the agenda item. So, item one, I'll have a brief statement of what that agenda item was, and then I'll have three or four names attached to it. Those people have to speak first. So the kind of rule of the game is, when you write an interrogation with an agenda item, you're also committing yourself to have something to say about it. So, and almost always there's more than one person connected to any given agenda item. It just usually happens that there's two or three. Sometimes there'll be five or six people. The idea is that the people who pose the agenda, they have an initial discussion with us, everyone else, listening in. Occasionally, of course, it's possible for somebody to jump in there as well. But this is a way of guaranteeing that everybody talks in a seminar, but that people talk about the things that they're most prepared to talk about. So at the end of every session, generally speaking, everybody has participated to a greater or lesser extent. In the seminar sessions themselves, I tend to be a fairly strong chair in the sense of kind of managing the discussion, but hopefully with a light touch, right? Strong chair with a light touch is my goal. Occasionally in the seminars, then I will give a homily on some theme. I'll give a kind of mini, exposition on some point after we've been talking about it. But this is really a seminar. It's not going to be introductory lectures by me with Q&A afterwards. It really will be discussion around the reading with me nudging it in various directions. Okay, so the interrogations are key. Those of you who are not kind of officially enrolled, I strongly encourage you, of course, to do that too, because I think it's a good thing. But, I'm not. I know you all have huge amounts of other obligations, and it's not. I won't be mad or disappointed. Don't worry about it.
Well, we won't ever get to talk.
No, you'll still get to talk.
No, just tease. Yeah.
Okay. Is that all clear? Any questions about the interrogations? On length on the interrogations, okay. If there is an occasion where bigger isn't better, this is one, partially because everybody has to read them. But this is a case, it's absolutely fine with me if on some reading you really have something you want to talk about. You lay out the question and issue and then you elaborate it. It's fine if it ends up being long. Occasionally people write interrogations that are, 400 or 500 words would be about as long as they ever get. Mostly, though, the idea is a couple of hundred words, sort of a half a single space page. Sometimes it can be even shorter than that if you really can hone in on something you want to talk about. Another thing not to do is to write an interrogation where you've got 9 things you want to talk about. Right? I want to talk about the following, and then you just have a whole bunch of questions. You should really focus in on what it is you really want to talk about. Sometimes it's a compound question. I don't mean to be simple-minded to say that everything has the form of a sentence with a question mark after it. No, it can be a compound question if it really is a linked agenda, but avoid having too many points in your interrogations. Every once in a while, I read an interrogation and I can't figure out how to turn it into an agenda item. So it does happen that sometimes a person's agenda item doesn't appear on the class agenda. because I couldn't figure out exactly how to do it. It's not because I didn't approve of the agenda item, it's because I couldn't distill it into an agenda item. So if that happens, then we should just discuss why it happened and try to move on. Usually, it often takes, my experience is usually takes a couple of weeks before everybody fully gets this, just because it's not a familiar way of thinking about what it means to write something short about the readings. There are, I'm sorry, I'm just sort of meandering along here. There are a couple of weeks which have the following character. I think this will be the week when we, for example, this book, Social Enterprise, Global Comparison. This book has chapters on different countries. You know, it's got a chapter on Western Europe, a chapter on East Central Europe, a chapter on Southeast Asia, a chapter on the United States, a chapter on Zambia and Zimbabwe, a chapter on Argentina, a chapter on Japan. These are basically case studies. And so a natural way of organizing that is when you read this book, I don't expect everybody to read every case study super carefully. What I would recommend is that you read it, you skim through everything, but if you find a particular country case study that you really find interesting, you read that one carefully. And then a kind of natural way of organizing that discussion is to have agenda items that are anchored in particular case studies, and then for us to be doing comparative things in the course of our discussion. So there's a couple of books that have that character. All right, let's take a 10-minute break.